Oh, yes.
I wasn't sure I was in the right place, but after hearing Myron tell that story, I know it. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I pass. Go ahead. You know, you recommended me. You want to talk to the missus and work your way out of this, Myron. It's up to you. Would you humor me, seeing as we got away with this bell ringer story? Would everybody here say bang very loudly? One, two, three, bang! Okay, we got the meeting off with a bang just like you want. My name is John. I am the recovering mate of a recovering member of Al-Anon. Some man in the back before said, I can't hear. My wife changed places with him. She was very, very nice. Speaking at a home group a few weeks ago, I started talking and a man in the back yelled out, you know, look at that big windbag. You don't know what you're talking about. So I stopped. I looked at the chairman and he quieted him down. I started again. The guy said, you're a big windbag. You have no idea what you're doing up there. So I walked over, I said to the chairman, look, would you please quiet him down or I'm not going to talk. He says, you have to talk. I said, why? He says, you're the first one he's ever listened to. I'd like to thank Myron for the lovely introduction. It is impressive. Like, even I had to be impressed by it. I was at a business luncheon a few weeks ago and there was it could be a little misleading. A gentleman was being introduced that he was from California, and he had made $1 million in an oil transaction. When he got up to speak, he said that there was a little bit confusion. He was from Pennsylvania. The deal was in coal. It was his brother, not himself, and they had lost $500,000. Since the beginnings of AA, two of our past chairmen, Dr. Norris and Dr. Maxwell, upon their rotation from the board, have been asked to serve as trustee emeritus. And with all, humbleness, I'd have to say that people have been asking if I would, in fact, someone said, would it be possible, I'd like to see him serve in an emeritus manner. Does posthumous mean the same as emeritus? How I got here. Shortly after I was brought home from the hospital by my mother, it was noticed that I cried a lot, I sucked on a bottle, and I wet my pants. 36 years later, The simplest way to put this is that, you know, I think I had a broken drinker. It worked very well for 36 years, and the thing broke, and I couldn't drink. It was that easy. You know, with the sharing, Nikki, to me last night, we have four children. And actually, only it was the oldest boy who saw the horror that she described of the alcoholic home. She brought it back to me. For Linda, forgetting anything about AA or Al-Anon, the talk that she gave, the gut talk, affected me as few speakers I have ever been privileged to hear share. I thought she was beautiful. With Bob, it was seeing a touch of our history come apart and come alive. And you know, I've heard Winnie, and I can just tell you, you're in for a super treat this evening. It leaves me standing up here with a lot of feelings of inadequacy. And I went to my, I'll get to that part of the story later, shrink or whatever we wanted to call him, and I told him I had these terrible feelings of inadequacy, and he said, Mr. Ryle, don't worry about it, that's normal. I said, what do you mean normal? He said, you're a very inadequate person. For those of you who have worked on the committee or have missed working on it to put this together, my advice to you who have missed it is to miss it. I'd just like to review that there are six stages that any committee goes through when assembling a get-together like this. There is enthusiasm followed by disillusionment and panic, a search for the guilty, punishment of the innocent, and praise and honors for all non-participants. After all of the sharing, there's nothing left for me to do but to tell my story. It's really a great story. It has drama. It's got humor, suspense, pathos. It's joy. It's a great story. It's a story, I guess, like a lot of stories Al-Anons have heard, of lost communication, of confrontation, screaming, yelling, and violence, bodily harm, the need of orders of protection. There's a unique twist on this story, though. I'm the one... Hear that laugh? Hear that dirty laugh in the back? I'm the one that needed the order of protection. At the end, you know, I wasn't a fighting drunk. I was a pitiful drunk who fell apart. And I would crawl into bed, take the last drinks in bed, pass out. Wake up the next morning black, blue, and battered, and wondered I must have fell down going to the bathroom or something. And then I heard that wicked laugh in the back make its first Al-Anon talk. I not only was, this is a program of spiritual growth, I not only was almost spiritually dead, I was almost physically dead. About as close as I got to spirituality at that time, there was a song playing on the Western stations. It was very tender. It was called "Dropkick Me Jesus Through the Goalpost of Life." Straight down the center, not to the left or the right. Spirituality. Let me take you to heaven. But before we get there was a situation on Long Island. This is known as the family groups. I'll tell the story this way. A gentleman felt that his wife was shilly-shallying. And he came home early one afternoon and saw a man running down a fire escape. He went up to his room, looked around. His wife was disheveled. There was no one there. But in a rage, he wrestled the refrigerator over to the window. As the man stepped off the fire escape, he dropped it on him. We now switch to heaven and St. Peter in the spiritual part of the story. The gentleman arrives and he said, "My son, how did you get here?" He said, "I don't know. I locked myself out of my apartment. I went up the fire escape to try for a window. I went down. I remember nothing." He said, "You're the victim of an unfortunate accident. Enter." Second man came up and he said, "My son, how did you get here?" He said, "My son, in spite of a good life and your horrible ending of rage, what you caused, you've lived a good life. You may pass." The next man was rather confused. He said, "St. Peter, I have no idea how I got here." He said, "None at all?" He said, "None." He said, "What's the last thing you remember?" He said, "I was sitting in this refrigerator." It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you got out there or I got up here. It's a beautiful sight to look down, and to this point, it's been just an incredible weekend. Our charming New York South Al-Anon delegate came up to me last night, and we don't know each other that well, and she said, "Do you have a warm fuzzy?" I'm not stupid. I didn't answer that question. We're going to say no more about that one. That's Thank you, Roxy. Let me thank the committee and bring you the best wishes of the Westbury Long Island group. And that was by a vote of 17 to 12 with 4 abstaining. You have your business meetings and we have ours. For the anonymity, we do it this way on Long Island. It goes something like, short and sweet, I won't tell anyone I saw you here if you don't tell anyone you saw me here. On the New York Times bestseller list, there's a new book coming out that has been reviewed, and the title is Drink and Be Happy. Now, there is a great title. And basically, it deals with the relationship between weight and alcoholic consumption. Parts of it were picked up by the state troopers on New York, and they have charts up saying if you are so much weight, you can take so much alcohol in a given period of time and not be judged drunk. So for anyone who is having a problem out there, and for myself, I would just like to assure you, you are not alcoholic, you are just too thin. We didn't go to one of the big New York airports. We went to the Islip Long Island airport. I'm not saying that the plane was small, but it started from a kneeling position. You can always tell when there are new AAs on planes like this. The stewardess was serving, and she offered this gentleman a martini. She turned to the alcoholic, and she said, "Will you have something to drink?" And he said, no. He said, I abstain. He said, rather than touch alcohol, I would commit adultery. And with that, the man next to him turned and said, cancel the martini. I didn't know I had a choice. And that, I think, is the story of most of we alcoholics. Until our entrance into the fellowship, none of us seem to know that we did have a choice. All right, getting on with this thing. I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also an only child. Now, that may not be a dual addiction, but in some... Thank you, only children. Let's not have this deteriorate into that mob scene you had with people yelling and screaming last night after... Well, we are the senior fellowship, and we deserve a little respect. So are losers. You've got one edge. You can drink and wipe the steps. We're still trying that one out. Not only was I an only child, I was a sensitive only child. I do a solo this morning, do you mind? As I say, it's not a dual addiction, and in New York now, we're getting on to some great things. We have people who are talking about having sedativism, chemical dependencies. I was at a meeting last week where a man claimed to be poly-addicted. Gentleman said to me, can you identify? I said, I've never made love to a parrot. He's out of his mind. One of my problems in growing up was that I always wanted to be different. As you can see this morning, I made it. Introductions. I got to tell us, a friend of mine, Stan, up in Canada, was put in the position that Myron was in. A friend was going to do an introduction. He said, how do you introduce John? He said, you don't introduce him, you explain him. There was a gentleman who had bought a beautiful grandfather's clock, and his car broke down, and he was forced to take his belt off and put the clock on his shoulder and carry it. As he was carrying it down the block, a drunk came reeling out of a bar, bumped into him, and the man almost dropped his priceless clock. He said, for God's sake, why can't you drink like everyone else? The drunk looked at him and said, why don't you wear a wristwatch like everybody else? Same drunk got to the corner, slapped the cop on the back and said, what time is it? The cop hit him over the head with the club and said, struck one. He said, thank God I didn't get here an hour sooner. Bill called one drunk speaking to another as Bob took us back this morning. The language of the heart. And both of our co-sponsors stated that, I want to get this right, the best way to assure sobriety was in sharing with other human beings. And whether I share with you or, as Bob mentioned this morning, when Dr. Bob went to see the classic Bill D, the third man, the so-called man on the bed in Alcoholics Anonymous, Henrietta turned to Bob and said, "You're the answer to a prayer." And he said, "No, I'm just another drunk trying to stay away from another drink." And I guess that's what I'm trying to do here this morning, trying to stay away from another drink by sharing. I come from an Irish background. Last night, we mentioned the so-called closet relatives. I guess we had one Uncle Mike. On a Sunday morning at the seashore in Rockaway, he was walking back to Ireland. He was saved by a priest whose hat began to float. This was a gentleman who left orders to be cremated. When they did this, they couldn't put the fire out. With these so-called closet relatives and the Irish virus, my family felt that if I was given alcohol at an early age, I would, quote, drink as a gentleman. And so from as far back as I can remember, I guess I sampled any drink that was offered in the household. And in my case, it worked out very, very well. As the years went on, I knew what alcohol could do. I had left automobiles as a wild kid and seen the drivers killed moments after I left. Drunk? No, I'd say a swinging package, a happy load, but not drunk. I had seen a brilliant uncle take a setback with a child that was born. Not normal. And a brilliant heavy drinker turned himself into a wet brain in 1 year. I knew what alcohol could do. And as my story goes on, I was given an assignment on what to do with people who were drunks. I'll age myself. I come out of something called the Big Band era. And on a night such as last night, you would find me coming from one of the roadhouses in New Jersey, coming across that George Washington Bridge in a convertible with the roof down, and the band that we had just heard playing on the radio, the lights of Manhattan twinkling at my feet, a warm glow on, a lovely young lady at my side, and life was beautiful, and the world was beautiful, and I was going to be a roaring success. Now, right from the start, I knew if you drank as I drank, occasionally strange things would happen. One night, in coming across Manhattan, which is an island, I came off the bridge. I was looking for the Queens Midtown Tunnel to go to the island. In the state I was in, either I hadn't gotten off the martinis or I had gotten onto the scotch and bourbons too soon. It was a bit hazy, and so the idea of a tunnel to me was a large hole in the ground. I made my left at the large hole in the ground and wound up at Grand Central Station loading platform. It was kind of hard explaining to the cop how I did not understand what the glass French doors were upstairs. But he was Irish, and I was Irish, and whether we sang Irish Soldier Boy or Mother McCree, he told me, drink no more, be on my way. Other things could happen. I could make a full stop on an interstate. I was asked about this by my wife one night about the red lights, and she said, those are on ships in the harbor. Proceed. But you see, if there's such a thing as a healthy attitude about drinking, I could simply call you up the next day, and I could say, hey, where did you hear the crazy thing I did last night? Fun and games, nobody was hurt, maybe the angels were sitting on my shoulder, but I just had no shame about having a bad drunk in one place. There was no shame and there was no guilt. Now, as I said, I was an only child. I was a sensitive, get this, Nancy, delicate only child. Now, until I was 18 years of age, my mother used to cut the meat before she served it. cut every piece of meat on my plate. Now, when I fell prey to this Irish bounty hunter, who was the oldest of seven, this woman refused to cut the meat. This caused a trauma. I'm not blaming the alcoholism on it, but it most certainly did upset my life. She just flatly refused to cut my meat. It was a bad scene. Sensitive. On the island, we have two gentlemen, and one is rather macho, and one is rather genteel. And the genteel one left his cat with the macho man, and on his first phone call, he said, how is the pussy cat? He said, your cat fell off the roof, and he's dead. He said, my God, don't do anything like that. He said, well, the cat's dead. It fell off the roof. He said, but look, lead up to it. On the first call, say, you know, your cat walks on the roof. You know, the cat walks near the edge of the roof. He said, you know, give me some warning. Say, the cat almost slipped on a phone call. Don't just on the first call say, the cat fell off the roof and she's dead. I said, all right. He said, anything else new? He said, yeah, he says, mother was up on the roof walking around. All right, this bounty hunter, this wife du jour, is my first wife. It's still my wife, but this keeps her on her toes, as Bob said it. But, if you looked up the word mean in the dictionary 24 years ago, you would have seen her picture. She spoke on a Friday night in Lubbock, Texas. I got a standing ovation on Saturday morning for being alive. In Wisconsin, they have a mural in the hall. It shows a leopard springing on a poor domestic beast with fangs and teeth. A good friend looked and said, there is the story of your marriage. This woman joined something which we refer to on Long Island as Operation Head Start. In its time, it has been known as the Auxiliary, as the, get this one, the AA Helpmates, the AAA, First Step AA, thank God for the last one, non-AA. We simply refer to them as Operation Head Start or the normal neurotic. Now, she joined something called the Aggravation Group, and they placed her on, they have committees, they're very well structured, they placed her on a hostility committee. At this point, she was speaking at 90 words per minute with guts up to 150. She had talent, she had progressed to the point where she could start a fight in an empty room. They gently said to her one night, my dear, he's a sick man. You don't want anything to happen to him. She said, no, I'm going to get him myself. She bought a nice little puppy. It was a Doberman Pinscher. She began beating it with my socks and underwear. At the same time, she was teaching me to say, here, doggy, doggy. She had a backup plan. She's a very intelligent gal. She was, if this didn't work, she was going to starch the collars with beef bouillon. If you look in the dictionary, it says that having one wife too many is called bigamy. In my case, having one wife too many was called monogamy. She went around singing, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. If I made a statement, she got one thing straight. If I made a great statement, she would hum and smile and look at me, and I'd say to myself, she knows who's boss. I found out later she had gone to something called a detachment meeting. I was being colored the same color as the wallpaper. I wasn't there. In order to try to prove I was sober one night, she said, you were drunk again. I said, no. I said, I was sober. I can prove it. I said, I saw the one-eyed cat going out the door. She said, John, the cat had two eyes and it was going out, not coming in. We went, or she dragged me, or we got someplace to consultation to discuss my drinking. Much to my surprise, when I got in there, the gentleman began saying that there were some offshoots of my drinking, and since this is a family group, the way he put it was, he said, your wife seems to feel that there is a sexual dysfunction. I shrugged. He said, she says that you are a bisexual. I said, the woman is completely out of her mind, doctor. He said, he's not talking about choice. She's talking about frequency, yearly. She says that you have reached the point where you feel that the word consomme is a soup. Respect, she was taking half a birth control pill at this time. I said to her one night, look, I just want to die in bed. And she said, what, again? The doctor said, Mr. Ryle, I just want to talk about this terrible thing that has befallen you. I said, shh, she's in the next room. And she was giving me encouragement. You know, the doctor told her, build up his ego. She was no longer singing, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. She was now humming, someday my prince will come. They say that behind every successful man, there is a successful woman. I can see this deteriorating into an equal of last night. Let me say this. That first wife became a delegate to the Al-Anon conference. Without me, she never could have made it. I want to share one thing with anyone who is living with one of these little beasties. I never criticized her judgment. After all, she did pick me. And I never told her that I was not worthy of her. I allowed her to find this out for herself. Bill speaks his success. He writes in the book that success for some of us was a wine which never failed to excite and satisfy. It was the sum total of my entire life. And I was a raging success. I was on top in my field. I had it. I had it. And if you didn't know I had it, I would tell you I've got it. This was later to be referred to as humility. It was sort of militant humility, aggressive humility, if you will. I came from a background of engineering, and strangely enough, I wound up in the field of industrial relations. And I came up like a rocket in the union, from the local to the international, to the head of an international education department, to at a very early age to be, quote, the advisor, the top hatchet man to the international president of the union. And I didn't give a damn for anyone or anybody's success. The sum total of my entire life, I would reach the top, I would reach the zenith. I never cared about when I drank or how much I drank. I was a daily heavy hitter. And yet, you see, if things begin to go wrong, and you're known as a heavy hitter, people are going to begin to say, he drinks. Not like he drinks, but he drinks. I spoke of a knowledge of alcoholism, This is better than 25 years ago. At that time, it was costing for arbitration of lost cases for discharges for alcoholism. It cost an international over $20,000 or $25,000. Hey, the employer had a book that thick. And the dirty word alcoholic was never mentioned. All that it said that the discharge was for failure to fulfill terms and conditions of employment. Basically, not coming in on Mondays and Fridays, coming back from lunch drunk. Poor attendance, poor work habits. And you see, you paid your money and you got your pick, and $25,000 went down the drain and there was a discharge. And so what did I find? I went to the Yale, Cornell, and Rutgers reports. I wound up with my own physician, and guess what? I found out that way back then, quote, Alcoholics Anonymous had the best track record. People not only stopped drinking, they seemed to be, quote, rehabilitated and lived happily ever after, and wasn't that wonderful? Good for you. Nice group of people, but just not my cup of tea. Now, I can pick up my story in this way. When our second child was being born, we wanted to have a nursery. It was a tough war. My wife was the flunky and I was the construction engineer, which is only befitting. And she bought a pattern of rocking horses, beautiful rocking horses, with a tough wall. I began hanging the wallpaper at 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, at this point, I was improving my breakfast. I was improving my orange juice with vodka. I was improving my coffee with a few shots of brandy. And she was feeling that it was not improving me. Anyway, with all humility, if you could see the first two panels, where they joined, they were magnificent. You couldn't see the seam, the rocking horses went together, and with all humility, you could have taken them down and put them in the Louvre. They were magnificent. As the drinking went on, the papering went on, and as the first wife puts it, when he got to the end of the first wall, the nose of one rocking horse was up the anal canal of the one instant. There is hostility. I've heard alcoholism called many things, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And in my case, what it did, it was completely mind destroying. Because if one thing made me a success, it was objectivity. And I lost my objectivity, the insidiousness of the disease. Things began going wrong. Things began going badly wrong. We hear of early intervention. There was intervention by friends. There was intervention by the head of the psychology department of Fordham University, a close friend and a Jesuit. No way. You see, I went to my doctor someplace in here. It was going down. And I asked him that million-dollar question, the man who had put me onto AA on an assignment. Right up front, I said, am I alcoholic? And he said, no, John. Not as I know it, not as that book states it, but I've told you for 10 years you drink too damn much. You're obsessed with success. You're under pressure. Back off. Stop the insane traveling. Stop the insane power drive. Live a normal life. I did exactly what the man told me. Objectivity, you're going to pay him, do what he says. You know what happened? The guy who laughed and drank and got the brass ring on the merry-go-round, everything I touched turned to gold, came down, and fell apart, and fell into the gutter in 18 months. After 18 years of laugh and fun and games, it ended. It ended not like dominoes going down, it looked like stone arch. There was complete and utter horror. And basically, I could identify when I came in, because when they told me I was alcoholic, because I could not tell what would happen if I picked up one drink, I had lived it. I had lived it. And I had reached the point where I couldn't live without drink and I couldn't live with it. It was a wonderful choice to have. I was going to die if I kept on drinking, and I was going to die if I stopped. It was a black pit. There was no light, no sun, no moon, no stars, no days, no night. Nothing. A big black Ephesian pit of horror. I was falling into it. So your objectivity, guy says he was smart. Why not go back to those basements where he learned about AA? sober up, face life, face a ruined career, face a smashed marriage. No, thank you. I would drink myself to death. I was in locked wards so often I was beginning to get well cards from doctors and nurses. In a last shot at finding out what was wrong, my final assignment in the service was in experimental submarines. They were looking to see the results of prolonged submersion. And basically, I knew, quote, my psychological profile. I wrote to the Navy Department and released those papers and went in for 2 weeks of extensive psychological and psychiatric evaluation. Wow, very impressive. Now, in case you can't tell, I'm one of the gifted alcoholics. Now, I wanted to help the psychiatrist and psychologist, so basically what I did, I got a big thick book on abnormal psychology. What I was looking for was a hyphenated word that would explain some of my actions. I would help these people. And basically, what I did, I found that I could identify with everything in that book except for two things. I was not an alcoholic, and I was not a lesbian. I have become so damn good, I have become my own higher power. And the only thing wrong with this is when you become that good and you become your own higher power and you begin that plunge into darkness, there's no place to go and there's no one to turn to. Shelley wrote that power, like the desolation pestilence that it is, pollutes whatever it touches. The power drive and the alcohol have completely destroyed my life. When I first came in, I said I had considered suicide, but I was afraid. And I don't quite believe that. Because in watching other alcoholics go through the progression, I know that some of the alcoholic schools call them the D's. Delusion, disillusion, disappointment, desperation, and despair. I thank the loving God as I've come to understand him for not giving me too much despair. Because over the 24 hours I have been privileged to be a part of AA, I have seen alcoholics who have been given that despair, and I have seen them end the pain and the suffering. T.S. Eliot wrote that this is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. The hard guy, the smug bastard, sitting at the end of a bar, falling apart, with two hands around a drink, trying to get it into his mouth to stop the shakes. And people no longer hated me, they pitied me. The object of pity. I had lost all feeling to share, all communication with the human race. I had long since ceased functioning as a father or as a husband. For the union, they were in a tough spot. You've got a high-ranking guy who knows where all the bodies are buried, walking around completely out of his mind. What are you going to do with him? They took a chance and they decided that they would fire me. But their idea of firing turned out to be ready, aim, fire. And so, at this point, not because I wanted to save myself, but because I had run out of locked wards, I had lost all spirituality, and I was dying, I came in through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my only intention in coming in through those doors was to live. To live. To do nothing else. Standing in the doorway was a gentleman. Well, it looked, you don't like to make fun of people, this guy looked like his mother let out one side of his hat. I came in through the door and he said, quote, "You got a threefold disease." I said, I beg your pardon. He said, threefold, you got a threefold disease. I said, "I beg your pardon, are you addressing me?" I said, what are you talking about? He said, threefold, mental, physical, and spiritual. I said, get him away from me. A guy comes walking up and he said, "That's one of our winners." He said, hey, it's not the end of the world. I said, "You can see it from here." He said, "Hey, beats drinking." I said, not by much. He said, this was pretty much like the man who went on his honeymoon with a gorilla. And on the first morning, somebody said, "How was it?" He said, "Let me put it this way." He said, "I didn't get all I want, but I got all I could stand." I came in here and I was half dead. This babbling idiot was yelling platitudes at me, but I was beaten. But I became obsessed with one idea. I said I had lost most of my humility, but basically, I was still looking for a way out, and I was also running for Rookie of the Year in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I had all the answers, great, great, wonderful, wonderful, good, good. It was great. I was obsessed with one idea. Now, I had lost many battles in my life. I never lost a complete war. And yet alcoholism was final, it was irrevocable, and I was finished. And so I became obsessed with the idea of finding what finally put me on my back and ended it. I went back into the Yale and Cornell and Rutgers reports. I went back and I read the big book, AA Comes of Age, and all the literature, looking for one thing, a way out. My wife said, "Why don't you go up to Yale?" I said, "I studied their report." She said, "They may want to study you." Trefo runs up and said, drinking again, he's trying to put toothpaste back in the tube. Smart. Luckily, one night, there was a gifted, brilliant young man up here speaking. I could identify immediately. Now, his story was basically that he was going to use a scientific approach to drink again. Pure scientific approach. Industrial relations and engineering. His idea was brilliant. He would find out scientifically which drink got him drunk and stop one drink this side of it. See, you scoff at these ideas. Have an open mind. He kept records. He changed his life like we're told to do. He changed where he drank, how he drank, when he drank. He changed his entire approach to drinking. He kept copious notes. Aha, laugh, go ahead, but. At the end of 9 months, he had proven he was not alcoholic. So how does that grab you? See, ye of little faith, you smirked and you laughed. He came to this conclusion in a straitjacket in Knickerbocker Hospital. Three fools comment on this was that was a good idea, like a parachute opening on the second bounce. I refer to myself as a retarded alcoholic for several reasons. One, I'm displaying. I stopped smoking and caught pneumonia. That's hard to do. I stopped drinking and 10 days later took a severe convulsion which put me out for about an hour flopping around on the floor. And in reading those books, I found that if I drank again, I would withdraw again. And this time it could leave me either dead or exhibiting more brain damage than I am showing to you this morning. But after all, if science wouldn't work, I had another out. The slogans, it said, "Let go and let God." I had a spiritual awakening. I prayed to God to restore my drinking powers for a miracle. Now, this may sound strange, but if anyone has any other way of beating what got me, please see me after the meeting. Now, the fact that I might die from this did not enter my mind because, after all, I would pray. Notice, I didn't say I wanted to have one or two drinks. I wanted to drink with my usual class, the way I used to, like a pig, is what I asked. So I went out, and I picked up that drink. It didn't work. Didn't work at all. I was 3 months sober. I was in fairly good physical shape considering what I was when I came in. I picked up the drink. But the Angles guy, the smart guy, had an angle, see? If anything went wrong, I'd go back to my group that night and say, other damn fools tried the so-called great chemical experiment, why not me? But one thing I hadn't heard at the meetings, the man who took the drink was not the guy who made the plans. So I didn't get back to Westbury that night. And smartass who looked up obsession and compulsion in the dictionary was now privileged to live them. The drink became no more than a dying man. Scared half out of my mind, I came back in through those doors. Guess who was standing in the doorway? You wish, I wish it was threefold. It looked like a middle linebacker for the University of Virginia. And the conversation went something like this. You look bad. Said, I feel bad. He said, you look like a bum. Said, I feel like a bum. He said, you feel like you let everybody down? I said, I feel like I let everybody down. He said, do you know why you feel like a bum? I said, why? He said, because you are a dirty bum. I said, where is the love? They don't usually give advice up here. But this is how you get a sponsor. Now, my idea had been... my idea had been to accept resumes. He looked at me and said, I'm your sponsor. I said, what makes you think you can be my sponsor? He says, 3 inches and 40 pounds. Do you want to talk to that? Tifo ran up and yelled, you look terrible. I said, look, be positive. He said, you positively look terrible. He said, the slip was caused by denial, denial. I said, look, you idiot. Do you know what denial is? He said, yeah, denial, denial. He said, there were shepherds. They were Arabs. They were in the desert. They were sitting down to eat. They had a bag of dates. They were in the tent. They held up the first date. There was a worm in it. They threw it away. The second had a worm. They threw it away. And the third. On the fourth one, they held up the date and they flew out the candle. That's denial. Bill and Bob both speak of the language of the heart, nonverbal communication. Bill mentioned one time that we should be very careful how we conduct ourselves because, quote, we may be the only big book that another drunk ever sees. When I came back in, I was given some very good advice. I was told to stop the intellectual baloney and to believe with a simple faith of a child. I was told to take a look at those steps. Chapter 5. I said, I tried that junk. They said, no, no. You know anything about the steps? They said, they came out of the Oxford movement in the Book of James. Now, co-founders referred to them as the building blocks of sobriety. And they expanded them from 6 to 12 in order that the drunks would not fall into the cracks. Look upon them as a journey and not a destination, as a means to an end and not an end in themselves. I said, I got the slogans. They said, the slogans are first aid. You need major surgery. It's very much, I looked upon them as a little boy who was in school and the teacher said to him, you have to go to the bathroom, raise your hand. The kid looked up and said, what good is that going to do? There's a gentleman who started AA in California. He was a close confidant of Bill, almost a sponsor, if you will, Chuck C. And in one of the first tapes I ever heard of Chuck, he spoke on the steps. He said something like, we didn't study them. We didn't memorize them. We took them. So if you want to live, you better took them. Basically, against my will, I was dragged, pulled, and pushed into those steps. And on one, I said, look, I know. I said, no, no. You were resigned to being an alcoholic, John. You didn't admit it. Unmanageable. Look at your life. It became unbelievable. You said halfway measures are value nothing. He said if you believe that you're an alcoholic, it says you will move on to the second step. And on that second step, I basically found, I've heard people tell me they had trouble. To me, it was a big cop-out, it was the key, it removed guilt. You see, it allowed me to get rid of a hair shirt. Responsibility I have, but not guilt. It told me I was a sick person trying to get well. I was not a bad person trying to be good. It took the morality out of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And basically, it gave me a splice in a lifeline back into society. But even today, that splice is soluble. It can dissolve in alcohol. 3 is the only one in my book that gives me a warning. It doesn't say that I've got to take a third step, but it tells me that the attempt I make at it will affect my entire program. It didn't say I had to define a God. It didn't say I had to understand him. It simply said I had to admit that I was no longer the captain of my ship. Life and will, what the hell was life and will to me? I believed in nothing. Yet I met a gentleman who was very pragmatic, and he said, substitute thoughts and actions to a code of ethics. So there it was. 1, 2, and 3, looking back, what the hell did I do? I couldn't stop drinking. 2, God could stop me, and on 3, I let him. We start to get into the waking steps. 4, what the heck was 4? I walked up to this beast one night, and I said, quote, I finished the 4th step, and there's nothing wrong with me. People step back, but wait, practice these principles in all of your affairs. It went something like this. He said, John, would you like the 12th step? I said, yes. He said, well, look at it this way. You'll have to go back and do it by the book and try to find one little defect. This way, when you 12-step, the poor devil will have something to identify with. Con job? I went back and I started writing. And I don't know whether or not it took 3 months or 13 months, but at the end of that time, I knew John. I knew what made me tick. I didn't go into how many times I had slept around or what I had robbed. I went into fear, self-centeredness, hatred, what I was and who I was. I rolled back that rug, and for better or worse, I met myself. It tells me I should go right at the 5, but I coasted. And I felt that I would take 5 with a religious, a professional, but it wasn't to be that way. And my wife had a kid sister, Peg. Peg is a baby of the family, a beautiful little blonde I carried around on my shoulders when we were engaged. Peg had busted a marriage, got hooked on drug, and busted Daddy's heart. The last step, Peg came to live with us. Didn't work out. Peg discovered booze. This is great. It's respectable. You get your high, you're within the law, and it's wonderful. There's only one thing wrong. If you're hooked on the source and you swing to alcohol, from observation, there's no break-in period. You're hooked with the first drink. And so Peg went straight downhill on the booze. It got completely absurd. And rather than bring her father back into this, God up here decided I would commit her. Because after all, she was a hopeless alcoholic. What else do you do with hopeless alcoholics but commit them? Someplace between the first floor and her bedroom that night, a little voice said to me, who in the hell do you think you are? The paragon, the eldest brother-in-law. You're going to have to give that kid a shot. You're going to have to tell her where you came from and what gutters you laid in and what you did. She thinks she's bad. You're going to have to show her what bad is. And so for the first and only time in this program, another human being heard my story as it's never been heard before or since. I didn't preach. I didn't proselytize. I talked as one soul in torment to another. And she only got one thing. She couldn't smell me. I was there in the hell she was living in. And it's great. Peg goes to AA. Peg identifies. Peg is alcoholic. It's great. But you see, Peg is a kid. Peg is a baby. People go in, people come out, swing a door. You got plenty of time if you're in your early 20s. Plenty of time. Sure you have. And Peggy, once in, once out, dead. 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 And my wife hated. My wife hated. She hated her God. And she hated her husband. And she hated anything in sight. Look at these bums in and out. Look at that beautiful kid. One shot. There is no God. Look at you, you bum. You made it. Hatred. And what could I do? What could I provide? I never lived with a person who was throwing his life away. I never went through that pain and suffering. What the hell could I do? Nothing. And so you see, I kid Al-Anon. And I fool around with them. And I call them neurotics. But those people came. And they supported my wife in that period of hell. And they saved her life and my marriage. And this is one drunk who was eternally grateful to our fellow fellowship. Six, I thought, was a beautiful step. To me, I thought it said to remove all the defective characters in my life. Speaker said last night, 3-4 ran up to me and said, alcohol comes in people, not in bottles. Drink, if you don't change. He said this to me. Me, brilliant me, who had figured out that alcoholism was caused by drinking alcohol. I had reached that stage. You see, basically, I had no trouble with this step. I just took all of my defects and said, go. Be gone. That's it. Self-centeredness, short-temperedness. Gone. All gone. Finished. That's it. Didn't work. Didn't work at all. It got absolutely funny. But you see, I did exactly what the steps said. I became ready. I became ready by finding out I couldn't do a damn thing by myself. And I refer to myself as a retarded alcoholic, and on 7 it shows up. It shows up very, very easily. Prefall said to me, quote, if everything else fails, follow the instructions. This is the same man's whose idea of a joke was to ask me one night, I said he was at a party, and he said to the host, do lemons have feathers? The host said, no. He said, why? He said, I just squeezed your canary into my drink. You see, on 7, I had gotten to 7, and basically what I had done, I was living a 24-hour program of drinking and abstaining from drinking, but nothing about living. And so basically, on 7, I asked God to help. And I didn't ask him for today or for now. I asked him just for the moment. And I was kind of scoffing at this, and the sponsor ran up and said, look, mouse. That's how he referred to me. If you believe that something outside of yourself, a higher power, could remove the obsession to drink, what else can this power do if you will only believe? Have you read the spiritual index? I said, yes, I have. I've read the whole book. In the front. He said, the back. The front, like, in the back. And basically, it simply says that there is one rule which is a blockage to all growth, and that rule is simply ridicule, contempt, without investigation. Or as the Alateens used to say, try it, you'll like it. On 8, a new word got into my vocabulary. Prefold again said, quote, do you have resentments? I said, no, I don't have any resentments, Prefold. What I have is pure hatred. He runs up to me and he said, look at it this way, it's fear. Fear knocked on the door, faith answered, and nobody was home. I said, run that past me again, please. This man just celebrated 25 years. People have come, people have gone. He is still there in that doorway doing the same thing. Resentments. A gentleman called home and asked to put his wife on the phone. And the matron is here, and sorry, she is in bed with her husband. He said, what are you telling me? He said, I'm her husband. He said, go into my study. They'll find a pistol. Get it. She came back with the pistol. He said, go into the bedroom and shoot both of them. She said, I have done this, monsieur. said, what should I do now? He said, take the pistol, go out in the back, and throw it in the swimming pool. She said, there is no pool in the back. He said, is this 224-76? There was a resentment. You see, nine simply said to me, after eight, I didn't have to do anything. All I had to do was to be a scribe. I didn't have to be a judge, a juror, a prosecutor. I simply had to answer the question, have you ever heard anyone in your entire life and do you want to do anything about it? Okay, but nine said, put your money where your mouth is. Do something about it. I want to get this one right. I was truly blessed because my children allowed me to play with them. And basically, when you take all of the junk out of my story, what had I done? I had taken a family unit and I had shredded it and I had destroyed a family relationship. And so on nine, what I tried to do was to put that family together. Now there was a relationship with each child and a relationship with the wife, but there was not a family unit. Do you know what the advice I got was? The wisdom of the ages, Try having one meal together each day. Wisdom. He said, try not to give one of the children the potatoes on the head if they displease you, old great one. I scoffed and I laughed, but yet strangely enough, it went back together again. Summing up, to this point, those steps are in retrospect. You can look back and you can cry and you can learn, but they're over. Reason 10, 11, and 12, for me, the working steps, the maintenance steps. 10, I got to watch myself. I said one night up here that the way I got 10 was thinking about the way a housewife would look at it. The nicest thing that was yelled at me was that you were a sexist pig. So watch this one for you house people who are out there. If you do not put, and I don't put the garbage out daily, it's going to begin to smell. And then it's going to begin to rot. And if I don't get rid of the garbage within me, the same thing is going to happen. 11 to me was a step of communication. This fool threefold had the nerve to say to me, quote, communication is knowing how to listen. Can you imagine a fool saying something like that? Communication is listening to people? Shows you how stupid he is. I read 11 fast and I thought it was something like that one of getting rid of defective characters. I thought 11 said, go through prayer and meditation to make God aware of my will. And I loved it. And yet basically 11 to me has been a very slow step. It showed me that I had a daily reprieve and that I was not cured. And in the beginning, I finally learned that I could pray for myself. And there was some growth, and finally I could pray for another person. And once in a great while now, when all my scheming and conniving fails, I actually find myself praying for God's will. Retarded, yeah, because 12 to me had to come in three parts. But it was the icing on the cake. It put it all together. It said, having had a spiritual awakening, and this basically gave me a self that I could live with. Carry the message to the suffering alcoholic, a cause that I could live for, and practice these principles in all of our affairs, a code to look by, to live by. When I came in, there was an old cliche that said, man takes drink, drink takes drink, and drink takes man. And this drunk has come to believe that man takes steps, steps take steps, and steps take men. Now, in talking to Myron, he said, the format is that you're going to talk a little bit, and they're going to listen a little bit, and for God's sake, try to finish before they do. Mark Twain told a story about a revivalist preacher coming to town, missionary. He said he was so impressed at the end of the first hour, he was going home, take a mortgage on the farm, and put the money in the basket. He said, this man spoke for six more hours. At the end of that time, I stole a 10 out of the collection plate. For me, this has been the program of the simple faith of a child. And this is one drunk who found a Tooth Fairy and Tinkerbell and Mickey, Minnie, Donald Duck and the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, all came back. A few years ago, it took the kids to see Disney on Parade. The two middle ones back to back thanked me for taking them. But the baby didn't say, "I took him." The baby looked up at them and said, "He didn't take us. He brought us with him." Freedom to grow, I hope so. This program has allowed me to try to become the type of person I used to despise. About goody two-shoes. It took a smug, self-sufficient loner to turn him into a person who loves people. I'm still the eternal romantic. A few weeks ago, the beginning of spring, I was out in woods, pond. There was a frog on a pond. The frog looked up and said, "I am a beautiful princess." "Oh, and I'm not drinking." "This is great." The frog said, if you take me home and put me under your pillow, I will be restored. What have you got to lose?" So I took the frog home, put it under the pillow. The next morning was this lovely nubile blonde laying next to me. That was 1 month ago. My wife does still not believe that story. For threefold, he is still out there. He's, I say, getting up in years. He celebrated 25 years. He's getting a bald spot. I said, "What are you doing about it?" He said, "I'm rubbing Preparation H on it." I said, "You're rubbing Preparation H on the bald spot? Does it grow hair?" He said, "No, but it shrinks the bald spot." Okay, let's wind it up. This a few 24 hours ago at a general service dinner, Bill, who was great for it, asked a rhetorical question. He wondered, could AA survive in a hostile and perilous world should such a world one day confront the program? He wondered if it could, say, for example, continue to function in a dictatorship. And he used as follows. "I think we need have no fear, but the cold winds blow if they must, the night darken. You and I know a land where there is the light is bright and there's a stillness of the spirit. There's a land we can live in for as long as we wish, for it exists really only in our minds and in our hearts. It's a magical land called Alcoholics Anonymous. The Lord, I believe, created AA for us. May it be His will that we keep it safe." Let me close with this. A monk was being chased by a tiger and found himself at the edge of a cliff. There was a vine hanging from the cliff. He decided to lower himself to safety, but at the bottom, looking up, was another tiger. In looking back up, there was a rat beginning to gnaw through the vine. Just then, looking straight ahead, he looked and saw a beautiful strawberry. He picked that strawberry, and he enjoyed it. And it was the best strawberry that he ever tasted. This day in sobriety, and you, with your Al-Anon, I and you can both enjoy the strawberry. This conference, you this morning, will always be a part of me. God bless you. Thank you. Bye.